Blog Talk Radio.
Episode of Movie Geeks United. How's everyone out there doing tonight? My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. And I guess I'm doing all right, you know?
Are you doing
well
okay?
As well as to be expected, you know?
Man, it's been so long. It's been, what, 4 days since we've spoken last?
It's been, what, Sunday night. So, yeah, you could say 4 days, 3 or 4 days.
3 days, yeah. So, you know, a lifetime.
A lifetime.
Like it's evolved since,
in dog years, at least. But, what have you been up to? Have you seen anything since then?
Yes. I went to a screening last night.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I missed the Tree of Life screening earlier today. But Dean is going to come on a little bit later to give his thoughts on it,
mm-hmm. Okay.
I believe, because he checked it out. But last night I went and saw Super 8, the press screening of that movie.
Right.
I really liked it, but, you know, with reservations. But I think that the movie's going to be massively successful. I really do. I know they're predicting a soft opening for it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
To kind of temper expectations. It's a $50 million budgeted film.
Right.
Which is low, by especially for summer movie standards.
Mm-hmm. Just low by anyone's standards, by today's standards in general.
Yes.
I mean, that's not
sadly enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's so they're Paramount's kind of, and it's an original film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a remake or a sequel, even though, you know, it might as well be a remake.
Right.
Because it is filled with Spielberg nostalgia, and it really does give you the sense of how you felt watching those early Spielberg movies,
mm-hmm.
like the E.T. and Close Encounters, and, you know, it has that comforting kind of nostalgic feel to it.
Right.
But it has major problems, I think, too, which I don't want to get into the minutia of what I think about it until it opens, and Sunday
right,
we'll come back when we both have seen it. We'll,
okay.
Trade off back and forth on it, but I do think it's going to be a major, major crowd pleasing movie.
Okay, well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, and the kids are great in it.
Mm-hmm.
The look and the feel of it is great. It's incredibly well shot, and the kids are so genuine. They pull out really good performances, each one of them.
Well, that's
and I like how there's not big stars in it either. So there's nothing to kind of distract you from the reality of what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not aware of, oh, that's so-and-so. I mean, they're recognizable faces, but just about the biggest person in the movie is Ron Eldard. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yes.
Well, that's good, though, for that, especially for that kind of movie, so I think that's good.
Yeah, so I expect a big opening, actually, especially once word of mouth hits. It's interesting, I don't know how studios come up with their gross predictions.
Mm-hmm.
I know they got it down to a science. I mean, there's some kind of room, probably a supercomputer, and dozens and dozens of people with number two pencils, and they're working it out. Isn't that what you picture?
Out.
Yeah.
Oh God. No, I'd love to know how they figure out these things. How they, you know, I'm very curious how they do come up with that.
Yeah, but we will talk more in depth about it, and I'll tell you my problems with it on mm-hmm. Sunday night when we can have a back and forth about it.
Right. Okay. Sounds good.
So what about you? Have you seen anything since Sunday night?
I haven't seen anything since Sunday. I mean, since the last time we were on, I've watched nothing really.
You know what I rented? I rented Revolution. Because when I went and saw Pacino talk, he talked about how Revolution wasn't done and it was mm-hmm. a travesty. It got him to quit movies for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'll give Revolution another chance because they came out a couple of years ago with the DVD of their re-edited cut.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting. It still doesn't work.
Okay.
But it's one of those movies that was completely blasted.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the States, well, everywhere, really. But now it's become a kind of new classic overseas, like in England.
Right, okay.
Actually, it's kind of done a Heaven's Gate thing.
That's what I was going to say. That's what it sounds like from what you're saying.
Yeah, kind of a revisionary
take
on that movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, the guy, we had on a guy who thought that was his best performance. Remember when we did that tribute show? He thought Revolution
really?
Was his best. Remember that guy? He said that Revolution was really one of his great performances. Remember the guy who wrote that book, The Films of Al Pacino?
Oh, Lawrence. Yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah, yeah. Remember? Yeah. He.
William Scholl, yeah.
Yeah, William Scholl, yeah.
He, you know, and he got blasted, Pacino did, for his accent in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that was the most heavily researched accent he's ever attempted, that he really worked on that accent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they took the particulars of that character's background, what accent he might have had, and they fine-tuned it. I mean, it was a very well-informed accent.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it wasn't in keeping with what most people assumed was the accent of that day.
Right.
During the Revolutionary War. I don't know.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. So you went back and actually watched that again. Cool. Interesting.
Yeah.
It's not something I would go back. I do consider that to be one of the low points, but
yeah, anything for my art. Yeah, and then I got A Single Man and mm-hmm. Harry Brown. I still haven't seen those two.
Right.
Oh, and I got a great movie today. I got to make sure I get the title right. I got one of those Roger Corman movies in.
Oh, cool.
On Blu-ray, no less, because if you're enjoying a Roger Corman movie, it might as well be in high definition.
Definitely.
Megapython and Gatoroid.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's is that the one with Tiffany and...
Yes.
Yeah, I think I watched some of that on TV.
If you actually went to the movie theater to see it, you could honestly say, I think we're alone now. Because there wouldn't be anyone else sitting in the movie theater watching it with you.
No, I think that bypasses any sort of theatrical route.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that. Like, I'll watch a really, like, fantastic movie. I like to go from stuff like Citizen Kane to Megapython and Gatoroid. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's
hey,
the kind of schizophrenic I am.
Gives people work, man. I think that's great. So.
Well, that's the full spectrum of movies. If you appreciate movies, then that's a good back-to-back double feature.
Yeah, it is. I don't think, you know, people, you need both kinds in there.
Yeah.
Really do.
Yeah, it takes all kinds.
Yes.
Hey, our good friend, a great friend to the show, she's been on, probably five, six times,
mm-hmm.
Talking about the art of editing, Bobby Osteen, is with us again tonight. She is moderating the Edit Fest New York event this weekend. And you remember last time she came on, I believe it was the L.A. event.
Right.
She came on with Craig McKay, who is Jonathan Demme's longtime editor, and we had a great conversation. She moderated a conversation with Craig during an event a few months ago. This time, Edit Fest New York, she's speaking with Ken Schretzman. Now, Ken is he's a very particular kind of editor that we don't appreciate enough, I don't think. Not that people understand editing enough to appreciate it as they should anyway, but especially when it comes to animated features.
Right.
Because no matter how difficult editing a live-action feature may be, editing an animated feature, it's times 10. I mean, it's it's an insurmountable task. When you hear about it, I just wonder how they do this. But he's edited some great, great films, including Cars, including Toy Story 3. You know, we've talked about how that's one of the best movies for us last
right.
year, Toy Story 3,
mm-hmm.
In no small part because of his contribution to that film as an editor. So he's going to talk to us, and Bobby's in on the conversation too, about what it is he does, what's involved in editing an animated film. Here is Ken Schretzman and Bobby Osteen talking about the art of editing. Enjoy. Okay, obviously I have to edit that part out. Man, as soon as I press play on the file, it freezes. Why does this always happen when we're when we actually have an editor on the show? We have a big chunk of the show we have to edit. All right, here it goes.
Okay. Right.
Hey, let's do this again. Here is editor Ken Schretzman and Bobby Osteen. I'm interested in, first of all, your career path, starting with what made you interested in film to begin with, and how did you follow that goal?
Oh, that's a good question. I got interested at a young age, probably when I was 9. My father had the family 8mm camera, took home movies, and pretty soon the kids got a hold of the camera. We started making movies of our own, mm-hmm. and, including animation, and I sort of followed through on that. Through college, studied some film and television radio in college, and just kept pursuing that.
So what was it about editing? Of all the kind of positions that you can pursue in film, what was it about editing that fit you?
Yeah, I think it was mostly like it was quiet. It gave me a time to ponder over the footage, and I just took to it so well. I didn't have, I couldn't imagine myself on a set directing people. I'm just not that kind of a person.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt like a comfortable place for me to be in. And I know some of the small things that I did as a student, that was the most fun for me, is sitting with the footage and putting it together. So I can, if choosing a career in film, that was the one place I could imagine myself being successful.
Right. In that early part of your career, would you be able to tell me what the most valuable lesson you picked up that you've carried on to this day?
In the early, you mean in terms of like what I learned on projects?
Mm-hmm. What's proven most valuable to you?
Patience. I remember on one of the films I made when I was a kid, I did two takes. I actually did two takes of something. It was a bicycle chase. And I learned that I did a splice between the two takes right in the middle of a whip pan, and it was invisible. And I realized you can do things like that. You could totally fool the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that stayed with me.
Mm. And tell me about, because you've edited obviously outside of animated. You've worked on movies like Get Shorty and Men in Black and
mm-hmm.
Some great films. What is different about the process when you're dealing with an animated feature?
Well, it's very different. It's kind of a backwards process. I like to say that in live action, they shoot the film first and you edit later. And in animation, you edit first and then they shoot the film. And that's the way it feels. A lot of animation is cutting storyboards and laying the groundwork for what the film's going to be. And, it's a complex process. There's a lot of elements that come into play. And the process itself is much longer. A live-action film could be, maybe 6 months to 8 months on the average. In animation, you could be cutting for 3.5 years to 5 years.
Mm. Mm. Well, when you describe it like that, that it's kind of you design you kind of edit the film and then you go out and shoot it. Does that leave any room for spontaneity or surprise or experimentation in the editing room?
Well, always. I mean, that's what you aim for. You don't want it to get stale, and you always want to, you know, make your cut feel like that's the first time it's happened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to make the dialogue sound spontaneous. So that's what you're always aiming for. But it does allow you for, you know, trying alternate cuts. And also in the case of animation, because, you know, as an editor, I'm involved in the story process. I'm essentially there working side by side with the writers, and being involved as the story's developing gives us a chance to look at the movie in storyboard form as a whole and going back to the drawing board and making fixes story-wise. So it gives that, you know, that's the kind of luxury we have in animation.
Mm-hmm. And Bobby, you were talking about how fascinated you were by Ken's work with Pixar, this style of editing. Tell me a little bit about that. What are you taken by with that process?
Well, I think it's so interesting that the editor has so much control and involvement. As Ken said, there's a lot of, I always feel that editors are, and I think you agree with this, that they're underappreciated and their work is in great need of explanation. And I think that's particularly true of the Pixar editor. I had no idea what the process was. And I think even, I know this to be true, actually, that even fellow editors have no idea, live-action editors. And one of the surprises is that, you know, that they're involved from the beginning, but also the layout stage, which comes after the storyboard stage, is so interesting because it's where you, I mean, and that you actually have virtual cameras and virtual sets, and it's really no different from live-action shooting, only you can change it. You're not locked in at that point. You're really only locked in at the animation stage, and even then you can make minor changes, but then it becomes very expensive. But at the layout stage, where you really are blocking out and staging everything and making camera moves just the way you would in different angles, different takes, and there's footage to choose from that an editor can cut, and that is constantly morphing and changing and evolving, and that the editor is involved in. It's as if the editor is sitting on the set and being involved in the process, and before that, sitting at the screenwriting stage and at the planning stage. So there's every single, there's no pre-production, production, and post-production. Everything
mm-hmm.
sort of mushes together.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it is that you can go insane because everything is at different stages at different times, and the editor is at the hub of it, and there's just constant bits of media flowing in and out of the cutting room, and the editor has to keep track of it, and you know, Ken was talking about even at the storyboard stage, it's like Band-Aids, you know, you mm-hmm. lock into a sequence, and then the actor comes in and does the final dialogue, and that changes everything because they improvise, and so you know, it's the challenge of it and the control is what really impressed me.
So Ken, do you often go insane going through the process that Bobby just described?
I would say I about 2 years into it, I'm pretty much insane. There's a lot of details to juggle. You know, at one point in the film, you know, part of the film is in storyboards, part of it is in layout, some of it is being animated, and some of it is being rendered, and you're managing all this material while still some of the scenes are being rewritten. It's a crazy process, and like Bobby said, it's constantly changing. You think you're done with a cut, and then the next day, you know, something comes in from a department that'll change your cut, and you make adjustments. You're always keeping on top of it. It's like a living, breathing organism.
Mm.
And even when they preview, Jamie, they're not even previewing the final version. They have part of it is in storyboard.
Yeah.
You know, that just shows how.
Wow.
You know. Yeah. So and
you know, we always feel like if the movie plays in storyboard, it's going to play like gangbusters, and when it's animated. You just know the story's working and people are connecting to the characters. You know, we showed internally, you know, Toy Story 3, and there's that scene at the end where Andy's giving his toys to Bonnie, and people are in tears, and these are drawings they're looking at.
Wow.
And you just know that when it's beautifully shot and animated and the music's there, it's going to be amazing.
Well, I can tell you, Pixar films, particularly the Toy Story films, I mean, I'm like millions of people all around the globe, they tear me up. I mean, I am a teary mess at the end of these films, so thank you for that, personally. So tell me about I would think that concentration is the major kind of attribute an editor has to have to be successful, especially under these conditions.
Yeah. You're sort of, you're using both parts of your brain as the part of your brain that's the technician and juggling and, you know, dealing with this Rubik's Cube of all the material coming in and making sure it doesn't fall out of sync. And then there's the other part of the brain is just playing the scene as a moviegoer and making sure it works on an emotional level and, you know, plays story-wise. It really keeps you fully engaged.
What I always am curious about from editors, and I've asked Bobby this before and other people that Bobby has brought onto the show, is how you maintain perspective. Because you're so close to it, you're reviewing so much footage, intricately involved in it. How do you do that? How do you keep your eye on, you know, going from the smallest frame to the big picture?
You know, I think you hit it on the head. That's the biggest challenge for me is keeping perspective, especially after you've been working on it for years. You have to remember, you know, the very first cut and, you know, like we were talking the other day about jokes that work that don't get a laugh 2 years later because you've seen it so many times. And you have to remember, oh, yeah, that used to work. And, you know, there's no need to change it. But in terms of perspective, you know, sometimes you just have to put a scene down and walk away from it and go back to it later. Mm-hmm. And I show other people. It helps to show assistants and see it through their eyes. And then the film itself, it's always beneficial. We screen it periodically at Pixar in the main theater and bring in different departments who haven't seen the film yet, so it's fresh to them, and it's really helpful to get their reaction to the film, and that's the way you keep the, you know, your perspective on things.
Mm-hmm. So when you do these events, Ken, because you've done Q&As in the past, What do people most want to know about what it is you do? What are they most confused about?
I mean, it's really the basics. After I go through the process, I think it's pretty overwhelming. Like, so, you mean the dialogue comes first and then they animate, you know, the really rudimentary stuff? Well, I don't know. I think they're surprised that the actors don't act the scene together. You know, every actor records their lines completely separate at a different time in a different studio, and I have to build the performance from scratch and make it sound like they're in the same room together. But I don't know what the commonality is with the, the confusion from the audience. I think it's you know, all new concepts. It's a lot to grasp.
So that would be a challenge to make it sound like there is a real interaction there between the characters when they're recorded separately.
Yeah, hats off to the director who maintains consistency across performances, because if you've got Tom Hanks shouting on one side and Tim Allen quietly talking on the other side, it won't quite cut together. So there's a lot of things you're looking for is, you know, the same energy level and...
You're also, as an editor, because of that, you have to control the pacing of the scene in a way that's more challenging than a live-action editor.
Yeah, I completely am in charge of the pacing and how tight the dialogue is, where the pauses are. It's completely fabricated in the editing process. You're not, you know, in live-action, you'll see the master and maybe get a sense of the actor's rhythm. And for me, it's really creating that rhythm.
Mm-hmm. You know, and this is just a comment that I don't know that there's a question in here, but we were doing a show months ago about our favorite sequences from films, and I think there's kind of a misconception, or people overlook the animated films in terms of the confidence of how certain scenes are constructed, because I did say just look at Toy Story 3.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the framing, the blocking of the characters, the editing, that is, some of those sequences are as confident as anything you'll find in the best Spielberg movies, you know.
And editing has never been, and editors have never been nominated for Academy Awards. And it's a travesty. In animation, I mean. It's a travesty, really. And I'm determined to contribute to correcting that.
Yeah, let's fix that.
Let's fix that. And cinematography, by the way. And special effects, I think, even. I'm not sure about that. But I just, I really do feel that it's not, you know, like the dialogue is one part of it, but there's so many aspects of the choices that the editor is involved in are just mind-blowing in terms of animation. People just have no idea. I think they just think that, you know, you just take shots and they just take shots and cut them together and cut off the ends of them or something. You know, that's, I mean, cel animation was very different, the old-fashioned kind of not 3D animation. It was, the editor's involvement was much more limited because once you were, isn't that true, Ken? Once the storyboards were done, the editor really wasn't that involved anymore. I mean,
yeah, my sense is that they just pretty much built on what the story reel itself and base layout on that and move forward. But in, you know, once you're working in the three-dimensional world, you have, you know, sky's the limit, and you could, you know, give yourself a lot of coverage and give you a lot of flexibility in the editing. You're not locked into anything, really.
And the other thing, the other aspect of it, and is what's unique to Pixar animation, is there's a reason why they're the most successful studio in the history of film. There's a degree of perfectionism. As there's a line that they sand the underside of the drawers, meaning that there's something called plussing it, which Ken and I just talked about today, which is which was a phrase coined by Disney, actually, and Walt Disney was really an inspiration for Pixar Studios, but this level of just never stopping and never just going to the nth degree to get everything so wonderful on every level, you know, and in terms of detail and story and character and gearing the movies for the child in all of us, not for children.
Yeah.
You know.
I wanted to ask you about that because Pixar is so incredibly successful. And so I wanted to know from you, from an insider's perspective, what's it like to be a part of that family, and how do you define what makes them unique and special? Ken.
Well, I know that working there, I mean, you're just working with side by side with such extraordinarily talented people, and you know, when you hand a shot off to another department, you know it'll come back, you know, so much better, and it'll be a surprise, and that's what we talk about in terms of plussing it. But I think there's just somehow in the culture built into it is all these high standards. We really expect a lot from each other, and it makes you better just being there.
And very collaborative. I mean, Ken, you talked about how it was an adjustment, actually, the fact that you're constantly, they constantly not only collaborate, but critique each other in a way that it's across the board. So everybody gets critiqued all the time.
Yeah.
And it's really ultimately very positive. You have to check your ego at the door a little bit and then give into that wonderful culture of we're all in this together and we're all helping each other. You know?
Right. And tell me what was unique about the Toy Story 3 experience. What made that kind of a singular experience from the other work you've done with Pixar?
I think that, you know, there was the legacy of the other two films to live up to. I mean, they're just such great films, and it's so daunting to think we're doing a sequel to that, but we really set our standards high and just roll up our sleeves and you know, manage to do that. I think just knowing that, and then, you know, continuing, you know, having to have the consistency of the characters, the personalities, and,
right.
you know, honor that, you know, there's a certain responsibility you have by having a sequel.
Right. And it is all about the characters, and I think that's what makes the Pixar films stand out, especially the Toy Story series, is,
mm-hmm.
is that it's all about their journey, and audiences mm-hmm. feel a genuine empathy for all of those characters.
Yeah, absolutely. They really feel connected and
yeah.
really care about what's going to happen and their real, you know, in a way, adult issues they're dealing with.
Exactly, yeah. Was there ever, because when I saw Toy Story 3, I mean, I was very moved by it, but I was also very taken by several moments that were very intense, very kind of scary. I'm thinking of when they almost got incinerated, and, mm-hmm. I was kind of terrified at that
yeah.
scene. Were there conversations about how far to go, or with that kind of content? Or?
Well, we just went for it because, you know, that was a key scene, and it needed to be there, and, you know, the concept was always, you know, what's the end game for a toy? What is their absolute worst nightmare? And that would be mm-hmm. thrown out and incinerated, and that's the end of it. So that scene had to be there. But we, you know, it was pretty amazing once, you know, it's one thing to watch it in storyboards, but when that thing came in lit and with the effects in it, it's like, oh, my gosh, this is like, it's big and it's scary. And we were wondering how the kids would take it, some, you know, we didn't have a problem, though, in the previews with children. That wasn't a big complaint, so we thought we were okay.
It definitely got me. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it worked for the film.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So tell me about Edit Fest, Bobby. Tell me about the event, where our listeners can check out your Q&A with Ken.
It's going to be, Edit Fest is actually taking place Friday and Saturday. It starts Friday night. There's one panel Friday night, and then there's four panels on Saturday. And we're the second panel, which is 11:45. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful event. I've been doing it since it started in LA and New York. I think it's both for aspiring filmmakers, for the public, and working. There's a lot of working editors that come to this, which is interesting. Which means there's, you know, there's always a growth curve there.
Yeah.
And there's always so much to learn from these master editors. And EditFest was very generous in letting me do what I wanted to do, which was do a panel solely with Ken. I really liked the one-on-one interaction
mm-hmm.
of really an interview format, as you can relate to, Jamie.
Yes.
and as I told you, I spent many, many hours talking to Ken about this, and I went to Pixar Studios initially to visit Ken and was fascinated by his explanation of his process, and he was responding to my great curiosity in such a satisfying way that I just really wanted to share his insights with the EditFest audience. I really think
mm-hmm.
there's, you know, it describes a lot that, I mean, it's sort of like an extreme version of being an editor. all the decisions and the creative process that an editor goes through at Pixar is just, it's like an idealized and terrifying world for an editor. And there's just so much that the editor is involved with. So it's almost exposes, you know, the editing process in a very intense way, and the filmmaking process as well, because the editor is so involved in the filmmaking process that there's so much to learn, I think, from our panel. And as I said, the Pixar films, the ethos of Pixar is very inspiring. And
yeah.
I think, you know, just all that I've learned from Ken and researching, I've read everything I could possibly find on Pixar as well. And the more I read, the more I find it incredibly inspiring. And I think Ken is a great communicator of his craft.
Okay, that is Bobby Osteen and Ken Schretzman. They will be doing a Q&A during this year's Edit Fest New York this weekend. Now, their Q&A takes place Saturday at 11:45 a.m. Edit Fest New York, it takes place at the Directors Guild of America Theater. It's on 110 West 57th Street.
Wow, okay, cool. No, that was awesome. That was good. I love when she comes on and does that. So that was really informative.
Yeah, and these are great, valuable events. And as Bobby said to us, a lot of editors, well, obviously, if you have an interest in editing, you're there, but a lot of working professional editors go there and attend their moderated sessions. And that gives you an idea that editing is it's an art form where you continuously learn. It's
definitely
a very kind of mysterious process, even for those that do it.
Yeah, no, it's mysterious, but it's also just because the technology is always changing, the techniques, and I mean, there's obviously some basics and everything, but yeah, there's so much. I mean, there's so many editors in this area alone. I mean, I can imagine if they had things like that here, they would be packed with working editors. There must be hundreds, if not thousands, of editors in this area. So,
you know, yeah, absolutely. Okay, we're going to bring on Dean, but thank you, Bobby, and thank you, Ken. It was a really terrific conversation with you guys, and I appreciate your time, and I wish you the best of luck Saturday. Everyone that lives in the New York area, if I did, I'd be there every single event. But, you know, and it's funny to me, because whenever you talk to New Yorkers, like, they always relate events. When I just read out that street address, they always relate events or I don't know, important moments of their lives by streets.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, everybody knows the streets. You know? Oh, yeah, I know exactly where you're talking about, the corner of 7th and Broadway. And you know, you can't do that here where I live. I mean,
no, and I understand. Yeah, I totally understand
It's something, like, unique to New Yorkers. It's just one of many things. Dean can tell us all about that. Isn't that right, Dean?
That's correct. I mean, you know, like, I flash back when people mention street corners like that. I flash back to, you know,
because you've stood on them all, haven't you?
I've been walking the streets in New York quite a bit. So.
Yeah.
But not anymore.
Now you're in Atlanta.
Now I'm back in Atlanta, and it's quite a bit boring.
Is it? Oh, compared to New York, I guess. Yeah.
Very boring here. It's, I might have to find some other place to live because it's just too dull in this
Bangkok?
City.
I mean, you're looking for someplace exciting?
No. I'm looking for something like, you know, something like, I want to go to a little town next. Like, I really want to go to, like, a little tiny town.
So Atlanta is boring to you, and so you want to change the pace. You want to go to a little tiny town.
Is that because of the
Well, it's just that I know everything here in Atlanta, and Atlanta's kind of like strip Molly.
Right.
It's a little ugly. So
Molly,
like,
is she strip Molly? What?
are you stripping again?
No.
And your stage name is Molly? What are you saying?
I did that up years ago, but. No, I want to go to some place like, not really small, but like some place like Asheville or Charlotte or some place like that, you know.
Because we have places around here in Florida, man, that are tiny. I mean, there's just like a stoplight and a feed store. I mean, that's all there is. So I got places for you here, man, if you want.
I don't think I want to do that. But,
I don't think you want to go farther south, it sounds like. I mean,
definitely not farther south. I want to go... I'd like to try, like, the middle of the country, you know, the middle of the eastern seaboard and see what's going on. But,
all right, sounds good.
But we'll see.
All right.
So,
we always talk about travel and directions and things when Dean comes on the phone.
Well, speaking of the middle of the country, Dean, share your thoughts on the Tree of Life.
Well, I saw it on Sunday night. I did write a review of it on Filmic Ability, so it's a little bit more articulately, what I have to say is a little bit more articulately done on Filmic Ability right now. But first of all, first of all, if you think you're prepared for it, you're probably not. Like, I thought I was prepared for radical change of pace, but even I wasn't quite prepared for it. It takes a lot of concentration. I don't think there's been a major mainstream movie like it, you know, released probably since the 60s.
I could see that, definitely. It reminded me of the times of Antonini films.
Yeah.
The pacing and the landscapes and everything.
Yeah, and plus there's, you know, in the first hour of it, you know, there's no back and forth dialogue whatsoever. I mean, it really takes about an hour and 15 minutes, would you say?
And it's whispering when we do hear anything. I mean, you got to have great hearing for this thing. You have to have superb hearing, because there are some things even I did not catch, and they're whispering. So, I must say, though, I don't think, I mean this, and I don't mean this in a bad way at all. It is one of the most religious films I've ever seen. And not in a bad way at all. I just mean there's so much iconography in it and imagery and just what's going on. I just was like, wow.
It is like, it does take its place as like one of the most deeply religious movies ever made. A few years ago, I think it was probably about 10 years ago, the Vatican came out with the 25 greatest movies about religion ever made or whatever, you know. I think this would have to take its place in there, you know.
They found 25 movies? That surprises me that they found 25 that they deemed worthy.
Well, they actually picked 50. They picked 25 that were about, that were directly about religion,
mm-hmm.
spirituality, and then they picked 25 more that were tangentially, like 2001, that were tangentially connected to,
mm-hmm.
you know, a search for a higher power, that kind of thing.
Right.
So, but I think this would have to, like, take its place there. You do need great, first of all, I think it's going to piss a lot of people off. I mean, like, I got the impression when the movie was over that there were a lot of people who just couldn't wait to get out of there. But those are probably people that, you know, are going to see Brad Pitt and Sean Penn and are not, don't know anything about Terrence Malick.
That's a good point. That's going to be curious to see as this thing goes wide or what happens.
Yeah. I mean, like, they were just, I talked to a couple when I came out of it that the husband was kind of being dragged to the movie by the wife, who was totally into Terrence Malick, and he was like, man, the last one I saw was The Thin Red Line, and that was boring. And I said, oh man, you're gonna be really tortured in this movie. All of this said, though, of course, the movie for me is brilliant. It is really a movie about memory. It's about imagination. It's about the unreliability of memory.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my favorite part of it, of course, is 30 minutes. I'd say it's about 20 to 30 minutes long. The creation of the world, you know, from the Big Bang to now, you know, and that sequence was just mind blowing to me. How great that sequence was. I mean, I think that's the reason it's getting compared to 2001 quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Although I would say so. But it diverges from 2001 in a very key way, in that in all of these scenes, there is no music. It's basically you just get a low rumble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Throughout, you know, sort of like a, In that way, it actually goes a little bit farther than 2001 did, and actually kind of approaches you know, Koyaanisqatsi territory. The I don't know if you guys have seen Koyaanisqatsi from 1982, Godfrey Reggio.
Oh yeah, yeah. I know who you're talking. I know what you're talking about. I don't think I've ever seen them all the way through, but I do know.
It has a lot to do. I think it has. I think that Malick has taken some inspiration from that film.
Okay.
And when you see it, you'll see it immediately. as far as the emotion in the film goes, I was really surprised that the last Malick movie that I saw, which was, you know, of course, The New World, it actually, you know, reduced me to tears at even in its first 15 minutes
mm-hmm.
by just how beautiful it was. And same thing with the last 15 minutes of the movie, too. This movie actually did approach that only one time, but it's not the kind of thing I can expect from, you know, every movie out there. So, I mean, this is not a negative thing either. But it did move me to tears one time when, I guess, it might be Alexander Desplat's music that comes up that it's probably the loudest, you know, most boisterous musical piece that's mm-hmm. used in the preview. And it comes up when the kid's father, played by Brad Pitt, who's trying to patent something that we're never really, you know, privy to what he's trying to patent.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes up when he's kind of emotionally standoffish and very strict disciplinarian at home. And finally, he has to go away on business for an extended period of time. And finally, the kids can burst out and start romping around the house, you know. And
they're very happy. I mean,
they're very happy to see him gone. But that was a beautiful sequence. I thought that sequence just, very nearly did that same thing that The New World did for me, you know. And I think it has a lot to do with the combination. In both instances, in both films, it has to do with the combination of the music and the imagery and how it's cut together and so
mm-hmm.
forth and matched with the piece of music that that Malick uses. It's interesting, you know, the music in the film, when you look at the closing credits and look at the number of classical pieces that are used in the movie, you can hardly believe it. I mean, there must be 100 pieces, snatches of about 100 pieces of classical music being used in this movie. So it's very difficult to say where Alexander Desplat's music actually
yeah.
comes in and when it isn't, because there's a lot of classical music that's used in it that I'm not really familiar with. That said, you know, the sound and music editing and the picture editing is superb. Of course, the photography by Emmanuel Lubezki is outstanding. The kids are perfect. There's one kid in it who plays the younger, the second son, you know, the middle son.
Mm-hmm.
That kid was so well cast because he looks exactly like Brad Pitt.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah, he did. I mean, no doubt.
I could not believe that. There's one shot of him that's like, oh my God, where did they find this kid? This is ridiculous how much
so,
he looks
so
like
Brad
Pitt.
So Brad Pitt's performance. I mean, people are touting this as one of his best.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, you know, I mean, it's weird because, you know, Malick movies are not always performance-based.
Yes,
so it's like... So he's good in it, no question about it, absolutely. But I don't think he's going to get an Oscar nomination or anything like that.
Yeah, that's a stretch. It's a great performance, but it's not, as I think you said at best, they're not performance driven. He doesn't make performance driven movies.
No, I mean the film making itself just sort of takes over and you know, I mean, there's like in the movie, there's rarely a moment that conforms to the way other movies go. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's rarely moments of back and forth dialogue and so forth like that, you know, like a traditional scene like we're used to in other movies. So so it's difficult to say, oh, well, this performance is great, because he's really just used as a tool to tell a story, just like the cinematography is or whatever. So,
well, if there's one thing that I didn't. The main thing that I didn't like about Super 8, and I walked out of Super 8 really feeling pretty good because of what I mentioned earlier with the nostalgic feeling and everything. But then I talked to the person I went with, my good friend Rick, and he wasn't as taken by it, and he listed off a lot of problems he had with it that I agreed with. But the major one that I agreed with was the fact that you watch Super 8 and you just think of, are you okay, dude?
Are you okay.
Choking? Okay.
No.
And you think about all the movies that it reminds you of, War of the Worlds and E.T. and Stand By Me and on and on and on and on and on. But you don't really think about Super 8. You know, it's
right.
Like it's got all it's made up of parts of better movies.
Right.
That was probably a big selling point to it, you know, for the studio.
Right.
They can look like they're doing something original, but they're not really.
And you know what I think? I think that's the problem with fanboy directors. Because they're, as a whole, because, I mean, Spielberg set this mold that influenced him, but he isn't setting a mold. I mean, he isn't concerned with that. He's concerned with paying homage to what's been done before, and I think that's like a typical fanboy attitude.
I would agree with you.
Am I being unfair?
No, I think you're absolutely right.
That's a valid point. I mean, if you're saying that this reminds you of those Spielberg films, let me ask you about another movie though. That it at least in the trailer, it kind of Stand By Me. Do you get any of that in there?
Well, yeah. I did mention Stand By Me. Just because
okay,
of the camaraderie between the kids. And look, there's a lot of stuff that's great about it. The look of it and the children are great. And they feel that you get the feeling of childhood for the most part in the movie.
I would have
preferred, like my friend Rick, that it not be about a monster. I would have preferred it just to be about these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the Super 8 movie has nothing to do. Super 8 has nothing to do with the actual movie. You know, the movie that they shoot doesn't have anything to do with the movie.
It just sounds cool. It just sounds cool, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem with fanboy directors is that, and this goes to directors of other generations as well sometimes, but particularly these days. The problem with them is that they're not making movies about that have really any kind of connection to their own lives. They're making movies about other movies that they've seen. That's been their life, you know. That's been their life, is consuming other movies and stuff like that. So they're not digging deep. It's not financially profitable for them to dig deep and these days and create something like Spielberg did with E.T. or whatever.
Right.
E.T. is a very, very personal movie for Spielberg. I mean, despite the genre that it belongs to, it's a very personal movie. So,
yes.
That
more than anything is what set the mold for Super 8, E.T. But in the main plot, the creature and the child becoming friends and misunderstanding each other with the government and all that kind of stuff, it kind of fails. It misses the boat completely. There are three major plot points in the movie that I have a problem with. And Jerry, as soon as you see it, I mean, we can talk about them on Sunday, pretty safely without spoiling anything for anyone. But I don't want to go into them and color your perception of the movie before you see it. Dean, you sound like you're in a wind tunnel.
Yeah, man, really hard.
Hang on, I had to put you on mute. Go to a quiet place, and then I'll unmute you. Because it sounds like Twister.
You both bring up a good point, though, because this is something, you know, that is the one problem, is that you're getting the movies that meant a lot to them, but just the movies, not really anything. You're getting that scene or that passage or whatever, but what is it? It's just a movie that meant something to them, but there's no personal, there's nothing there beyond that. It's, you know, it's a common thing in the last, like, 5-10 years.
Yeah, and I don't know. Maybe it's a generation of filmmakers that, I mean, like us, they grew up on movies.
They grew up on movies. They grew up more so with the VCR and cable.
Right.
And access, you know, we were talking about a couple months ago, access to 500 channels, and, you know, a lot of those being movie channels. I mean, it's like,
well, maybe that's
saturated.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Spielberg himself grew up on movies, and he
right.
made movies. So I don't know quite what it is. Maybe it is the accessibility of every movie at your, you know,
mm-hmm.
at your beck and call. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I'm curious. I'm very curious to say. I must say, it's a great trailer. Regardless, it's a great, great trailer.
I think you'll really enjoy it. I mean, I know the audience will enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kind of movie I was telling my friend when we walked out of the movie. It's the kind of movie that it's a shame that it comes out now. I mean, it's this nostalgic film for those late 70s, early 80s movies. But
mm-hmm.
the time it needed to come out was then, because that was the time when you could make a movie and it would have legs.
Right.
Now, if you don't perform to a certain standard on opening weekend,
you'll
disappear.
Doomed. You're doomed. And you've got two big ones next weekend that's going to be competing with Green Lantern and Mr. Popper's Penguins. So
this is a word-of-mouth movie, I think. And
okay.
if they give it enough time to generate a word-of-mouth, it's the kind of movie that could play all summer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what I
think.
Sense.
No, that's a good analysis. We'll see what happens. I mean, but, you know, it's sandwiched in between X-Men and Green Lantern right there. So, you know, they're all feeding off the same audience, kind of. But then you also have a big family movie next week, too, Mr. Popper's Penguins. So, you're really, you can't have good word of mouth. Look at Bridesmaids. You can have great word of mouth, and that
right,
works,
right,
and
that's right,
definitely
right,
working
right.
in your favor. So this could work, you know, too. So we'll see.
Yeah, and then you got Transformers,
which Chris thinks we're nuts for wanting to go see.
I want to. I don't care.
I
got a screening.
It looks good. It looks good. I won't lie to you, dude. It looks good.
I got a screening invite for Bad Teacher today too, so
that's
I'm looking forward
big,
to seeing
that's
that.
That's the big movie. That's the big one. That looks
yeah.
hilarious. I hope that's as funny as I think it's going to be.
Dean, it looks like you're in a quiet. It sounds like you're in a quieter place.
Yes, I. It was me leaning back in front of the fan here.
Oh, how dare you!
It's burning up in here.
Not the fan. It's the cop cars going by.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you guys? Do you have like a little home studio, like a little, you know, padded room or whatever that you guys go into?
We do have a padded room.
We do. I actually do mine from a panic room, actually. So I mean,
I just sit in my living room, dude, in my underwear, and talk on the phone. That's what I do.
Thank you for sharing that with us again.
Absolutely what I do. I'm being completely truthful.
Shame it's not a webcam show.
I don't have some kind of studio going on here. What are you, crazy? Yeah, we need to investigate webcam because they're wanting to do more and more of that webcam stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Dean, what are you doing? Now it sounds like you're
happened,
back in the
woods. What's going on?
I don't know. I'm just sitting here, not moving. Is it quiet?
Now
so, Dean, I want to know what's going on with your movie. Your movie.
Oh, what's my, the little 8mm movie that we're doing?
Mm-hmm.
We're in the process of writing it at the moment. I've already mapped out what exactly is going to happen in it. It's going to basically be a movie about depression, which is something I suffer from. And it's going to be a comedy. So, and it's going to be completely silent. So, you know, I went to go see Tree of Life the other day with the gentleman I'm making the movie with, Tim O'Donnell, and we thought that seeing Tree of Life was actually beneficial to instruct us on how to make a movie like that's pretty much fans dialogue. So, so we're gonna film it. I think we're going to film it sometime in August, and we've got We've got Colonel Bruce Hampton's going to be in it. He was in Sling Blade and some other, you know, Atlanta actors and so forth. Atlanta's actually shooting up there. It's like one of the big locales to make movies now.
Yeah. You got The Walking Dead they're filming right now.
Well, we've got Walking Dead here. I know we've got...
we've got a lot of Walking Dead here, too.
Yeah. we've got the show Drop Dead Diva, which is being filmed here. And also we've got the new the American Pie sequel, American Reunion.
Oh, okay.
That's filming here.
Oh, they're making another one of those?
Yeah, they're making... Now, let me ask you this. I don't know much about it, but are they basically assuming the straight-to-video sequels never happened or whatever? Or I
guess so. You know, that's funny. It's funny. I don't really... But it is the reunion of the entire cast. I mean, I think it's everybody is back in it. So,
well, that's something to look forward to.
I guess so.
Was that sarcasm? I'm sorry.
I do like the original, though. Don't you like the original a little bit?
Oh, yeah, the original. I know, the original's fine. I like the original. But you can tell with the sequels, the ones that came out in theaters, at least, they were scraping the bottom of the barrel. They didn't know what to do, especially by the time the third one comes around, and they couldn't get everyone from the original to come back, so.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so. But the next time I'm going to go to the movies, I think I'm going to go to I'm going tomorrow night to go and see a documentary called American Grindhouse.
Oh, that's playing near you. Cool. I want to see that. That looks good.
And they're playing it on a double bill with Rolling Thunder.
Wow.
The,
awesome.
The Paul Schrader movie.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's really a John Flynn movie, but written by Paul Schrader. So that should be pretty interesting. There's a film theater here at Georgia State University, which is my alma mater, called CineFest, and they recently asked me to be a programmer there. They want me to start programming a monthly series sometime in August. So I'll be able to pick, you know, any movie that I want and go and host it and you know, get a good, nice 35mm print of whatever film that I want to see. So,
cool.
That's gonna be fun.
That will be fun.
Yeah.
You guys see MTV the MTV Movie Awards at all?
I was watching Game of Thrones and The Killing, so I really missed them completely.
All right.
But it was the Twilight Awards, I heard.
I mean, it's been the Twilight Awards for the last 3 years, hasn't it?
I guess. Oh. I mean.
Yeah. You know, what always cracked me up is that every Inside the Actors Studio with James Lipton, in that very classic-sounding, authoritative voice, professorial voice, whenever he announces his guests on Inside the Actors Studio, he always brings up the MTV Movie Award and the Blockbuster Popcorn Award that they win alongside their Oscars and Emmys and Tonys and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, speaking of Tonys, Pacino's going to win one this Sunday night.
I think so.
I think that's definite. I mean, definitely.
Absolutely.
And then he's probably got another Emmy in his future for when he does Bill Spencer.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great casting, by the way.
I think so, too. I'm in complete agreement with you.
I think that's superb casting. So the show was pretty good, huh? You went to go see him. Did you get to, you know, ask him for an interview or anything like that?
I passed a letter.
Anywhere close to that?
I passed a letter from someone to him, apparently.
Right.
Yeah.
I figured that was, you know, that's good, though. Good that you did that.
I walked up to this guy. There was two guys, both in black suits, each end of the stage. I walked up to this guy. I was like, how you doing? Are you security? He said, no, I have nothing to do with this. And I was like, that's all right. You could tell me. And I said, look, I have a letter. I want to get it to Mr. Pacino. How do I do that? And he said, just give it to one of those ladies over there. So I don't know. He was pretty tough looking. And, you know, little old me with a fan letter in my hand, you know, shaking, walking up to him. You know, it was pretty intimidating. Anyway, in a little bit, we will have an interview with actor Kurt Fuller. He's been in so many movies and great TV shows. All right. Mute that for a second. Like movies like Autofocus and Anger Management. He's in the new Woody Allen movie, Midnight in Paris, which opens up wider this Friday. And we're all in agreement that it's one of Woody's best recent efforts.
Oh, I would say it's my favorite since Deconstructing Harry, I would say. It's like
yeah.
That one of my, I mean, there are others I like since then, but this is really the first one that's really, really, I think, right up there.
Well.
With a comedy like that, I mean.
This is a really interesting conversation about Woody Allen and working with him, what he's like to work with. So this is enjoyable for any Woody fan out there. All right, Deed.
All right.
We're going to have to let you go. Get away from that tornado, okay?
Oh, God.
All right. All right, I'll talk to you guys a little later.
Take care, man. Thank you.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. So you'll be seeing Super 8 this weekend. You know what I saw? I watched that HBO, the documentary that HBO bought, one of them, because they always scout Sundance especially.
Right, yeah.
To buy their documentaries that they premiered during the summer. That Bobby Fischer, Against the World.
How was that?
Great. Fascinating guy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I like the way it's cut, the documentary, because, I mean, the crux of the documentary is the Russian champion, when he went up against the Russian champion. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot on the line here because, I mean, we were kind of at odds, you know, the Cold War and everything. And so it represented a lot more than a chess game. It was
right.
Like the reputation and the integrity of the United States was at stake.
Yeah.
In some way with this chess match. And Bobby Fischer, while he was genius, probably the most genius chess player that ever existed, he wasn't very into pleasing his audience or kowtowing to any kind of demands or he didn't do well under that kind of pressure. And he was kind of rebellious, but so the way the movie's cut, that's the centerpiece of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in between matches, it goes back to give you a sense of who Bobby Fischer is, you know, childhood friends, family, other people that were associated with him throughout his life. It constantly cuts back and forth. So what it does is you get to know him as the movie progresses, but it also builds up that suspense for that match.
Right.
Because you know the outcome of the match if you know anything about the history of Bobby Fischer, but it still creates that suspense. I thought
it
was interestingly designed.
Cool. No, definitely check that out.
Yeah, I pulled it up on demand. It is a great one. I just love their documentaries by and large. They have great taste in the documentaries they choose. Okay, let's get to our next interview. Which I just said, Kurt Fuller is a great, great actor. You know the part that he played in Autofocus?
What part was that? I haven't seen. When was I saw?
Is that
was
Colonel Klink? Is that the
oh,
character?
Oh, that's right.
Name?
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I made sure I asked him about Paul Schrader and talked a little bit about Nicholson and Anger Management. And, but most of this is about Woody Allen and the process of working for him and how unique that process is. First of all, Midnight in Paris, the new Woody Allen movie, opens up wide this Friday. Here's a preview.
I mean, this is unbelievable. There's no city like this in the world.
You're in love with a fantasy.
I'm in love with you.
What are you doing here? Dad's here on business, and we just decided to reload along.
Oh!
It's great. We can spend some time together.
Well, I think we have a lot of commitments, but I'm sure it's... We'll,
what?
If I'm not mistaken, Rodin's work was influenced by his wife, Camille.
Rose was the wife.
No, he was never married to Rose.
I hope you're not going to be as antisocial tomorrow.
I'm not quite as taken with him as you are. I mean, he's a pseudo-intellectual.
Slightly more tannic than the 59. I prefer a smoky feeling. Carol and I are going to go dancing.
Yes.
We heard of a great place. Interested?
No. I don't want to be a killjoy, but I need to get a little fresh air.
What time did you get in last night?
Not that late. I'll probably end up going on another little hike tonight.
Where'd Gil run off to?
Been walking around Paris.
Where do you think Gil goes every night?
He walks and gets ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you so dressed up?
I was just doing a little writing.
You dress up and put on cologne to write?
Because you know how I think better in the shower and I get the positive ions going in there.
I had a private detective follow me.
And what happened?
I don't know. The detective agency says the detective is missing.
I'm in... very perplexing situation.
First of all, I was going to Berkeley in the 70s when Woody Allen really started making an impact on the movie world.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been a, so let's see, 70, 35. I've been a huge fan of his for 35 years, really.
Mm.
And he was, for us, you know, he was a hero, you know, way back, probably before you were born. And out of the blue, I mean, usually to get a job, you have to audition, meet, send your tape. They've seen you in something. Just out of the blue, my agent got a call saying, there's interest in you for this Woody Allen movie. And I was like, oh, forget it. That's never going to happen. Woody Allen, he doesn't know who I am. And then, lo and behold, 2 weeks later, they want to offer you this part. I go, well, what part? What's the movie? And there's no title, and he doesn't release his scripts.
Mm.
I said, well, okay, fine. I still want to do it. It's Woody Allen. I'll carry his luggage if that's what he wants me to do. So then I'm told somebody is going to come to your door. They're going to have something for you to read, and they're going to wait for you, and after you finish reading it, you give it back to them. And, you know, it's sounding more and more interesting and, for me, unusual than anything I've ever done before. So at 1:15, this guy drives up. He comes to my door. He hands me the little envelope, and in it is a note from Woody, which is now framed in my office, which says, you know, I thought you would enjoy this part. If so, great. If not, maybe something down the road, signed Woody. And then there's just the parts of the script that I'm in.
Uh-huh.
And everything else is blacked out. It sort of looks like an Al-Qaeda confession or something. And it's sort of a redacted version of this of the parts of the script that I'm in. And I read it, and I go, wow, this looks interesting. This is, you know. But that's all I knew of the movie, and while I was shooting the movie, that's all I knew of the movie. I knew nothing else about it. And no one in the cast knew what anyone else was doing, and no one would talk about what they were doing. Even the parts of the movie where my wife goes and does the shopping spree without me, or goes shopping for the chairs, never knew about it. She never talked to me about it when we would meet. I'd say, what'd you do yesterday? She'd go, oh, I, you know, did a little something with Woody. But no one talked. I didn't know what happened in the movie until I read the first con review.
Wow.
And it was really one of the most unusual, and I know this, I've heard before, this is the way he works. He doesn't want you to know. He only wants you to know what you're doing and nothing else. And it somehow worked out.
Tell me what that sounds very, it's obviously very different, that approach, but as an actor, what is the benefit for you in terms of performance, building a performance?
Well, for me, first of all, But what I was worried about was not having any context. In other words, mm-hmm. here I am doing a scene with Owen Wilson, not having read the script. I don't know how long he's been with my daughter. I don't know even that they're engaged. I don't know what's going on. When I first got there, I didn't know anything. And I didn't want to ask because I felt like, you know, this was the way he did this for a reason, and if he wanted me to know, he'd tell me. So I figured I'd go with my instincts and give it my best shot, and if he didn't like it, he'd let me know, and which is exactly what I did. And it sort of made everything, I don't know exactly how to put it into words, but it made it extremely pure in that I was just right there, right then, talking to him, and not, you know, I didn't put any spin on anything. I didn't put any contextual sort of backspin on anything. It was just whatever was happening right then in the moment was what I was playing. And, you know, I think, you know, one of his geniuses is that he casts incredibly well. And yeah. I think everybody was spot on. And believe me, no one, I think Owen and Rachel were the only people who had read the whole script.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I think that it kind of forces you to be in the moment because the moment is all you've been given.
That's right.
In a way.
I didn't want to say be in the moment because it's such a cliche, but that really is what it is. You are right there in the moment, and you know what you think about the person, what you're supposed to think about the person, what you think about the person doesn't exist. It's only the person right in front of you as they are. And, you know, it kept me from, it made me only judge what he was saying at that moment and not anything that I thought he had said or I read that he'd said or anything else I would know about him if I'd read the script.
Mm-hmm. So being a fan of his for so many years, what surprised you about the man and the director?
Well, you know, his movies are, to me, have always seemed, you know, I'll just go with the comedy because this was a comedy. Comedy has to be so calibrated and timed and put together, and Woody does not do a lot of coverage. It's not even, once he, you know, he's been doing this a long time, and, you know, once he had what he wanted, he knew it, and there was no, you know, he has a lot of confidence in what he's got. And if he didn't like it, if he saw it that night, he'd just reshoot it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Which he did sometimes.
Well, you must have been tempted to pick his brain. So you didn't get to do that at all.
I didn't. I did. I had one. I must have said one thing that interested him because in one of the scenes, he came up and I said, I said, have you ever thought about doing stand-up again? And for some reason, that piqued his interest. And he sat down and he talked about how, well, you know, he would. He does like, he loves, you know, being in front of an audience. He loves that thrill. But, you know, he'd have to put together a whole new act. And he's, you know, he doesn't have the time. And he's not going to, you know, he's not going to put together a whole new act now. But that was the one extended conversation. I thought it was interesting.
I still play his stand up. It kills me every time I hear his stand up.
I know. And the man himself, when you're around him, because I remember him from his early days. I think he was on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he his earliest stand up that was on TV. I never saw him in New York or anything. It's the same guy, but he's very. He's very quiet. Yeah, he doesn't talk loud. He comes up very close to you when he talks. It's sort of like if you took Woody Allen, the Woody Allen you've seen, you know, doing his stand-up, and then reduced it by 70%, but kept his entire personality. That would be what it was like to be around him. Extremely relaxing, actually.
Mm. And I've heard that he, in terms of offering actual direction. There's very little of that unless you're doing something wrong.
Yes. The one thing he said that hurt the most And he opened a couple of inserts. I was doing something. The one at the end where we're in the bathrobes and we walk in and he's leaving. Mm-hmm. He stopped and he came out. He goes, "What are you doing? You look like you're in a sitcom." And I said, "Well, you know, it's your words. I don't want to change anything. He goes, "Don't worry about what I wrote, because you know I think of him as Shakespeare, you know, or a great playwright. You don't change somebody who's clearly talented and brilliant and better than you at wordcraft. You don't put your own in." And he said, "Just mess it up, make it messy, make it your own, do it." And that was very freeing. And the second he said that, I just, you know, we all did. We all just sort of, you know, relaxed and didn't, you know. There's a tendency when it's on the printed page and it's written by Woody Allen to try and almost act by the numbers, and that was a mistake. And once he told us it's not such nonsense, it got a lot better.
Yeah. Have you ever heard the kind of infamous story about his experience with Sean Penn? Sean Penn told a story that he offered very little direction, but one time he came up to Sean Penn during Sweet and Lowdown and said, "You know what was wrong with that take? Everything."
I have a story for you. I did a couple of movies with John Cusack, and John Cusack, I think, did Bullets Over Broadway.
Yeah.
And he and I forget the other actor, they were doing a take, and all they heard from, they didn't see Woody. A lot of times you don't see Woody. He's over by some other room by the monitors looking. Over and over and over again, and no one would give them any direction. They just was, "Do it again, do it again, do it again, do it again." Finally, after about 6 hours of this, and they were shooting in New York, the first AD goes, "Okay, Woody's going to come down and talk to you." And they look at you and they go, "Finally, he's going to come down and tell us, you know, what we're doing wrong so we can do this." So he comes down and he looks at me and he goes, "Guys, Nick's in 20 minutes." And that was the whole thing.
And
he left.
Oh, that's great.
And that's that. Yeah, and you know, I believe it. And you know, they did it again, and they went home, and he had it. So, he is not going to tell you how to do it. Let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. And so you're playing this piece of this puzzle, and mm-hmm. you don't know what makes up the rest of that puzzle. So when you finally saw the finished film. Tell me about that experience. Tell me your thoughts on it.
It was at the LA premiere, actually, and mm-hmm. it was so enchanting. And I was, because I was playing a person who was quite antithetical to the person I am. Mm-hmm. I had tried very hard to not judge him or play his politics. I was really playing, "I love my daughter, I want the best for my daughter." I tried to play all the positive things about him that I could. Because, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody's an a-hole, they're already an a-hole, so you try and play the opposite of that. Because what's on the page is already there. You're trying to bring other things to it. And mm-hmm. and I felt like, for me personally, I felt like I pulled it off for the most part that, you know, at least I'd given the guy some dimension, and I could tell me anyway that I was concerned about my daughter, mm-hmm. Which was for me a personal victory. But the movie itself I found absolutely enchanting, and the stuff, the thing where he goes into the past and just everything, the design, the performances, the casting, the tempo, the writing, there's just something indefinable about this movie, how it all comes together, and the seamless. I love that he didn't explain how he got to the past. I love the way mm-hmm. he handled mm-hmm. everything. And I had spent a lot of time with Owen Wilson on the set, and I understand that, you know, he's sort of the surrogate Woody Allen, that, you know, Woody Allen's too old to play Woody Allen in his movies now, or the part he would normally play. But I think that Owen Wilson, the sort of, he's so different than Woody.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he does those words, he becomes an amalgamation of himself and Woody Allen, and he became this sort of glorious third person that I thought worked really well, and so great that you know, he cast somebody so far away from himself in this part.
Yeah.
And I think it created a third person with a whole other dimension that worked brilliantly.
Mm-hmm. He is
and
fantastic in the movie, yeah.
Fantastic.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. You know, everybody's good. It's just, you know, very rarely do I go to movies and think everybody's good. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, he casts well and he can get whoever he wants, so.
And it's so rare for me to be charmed by a movie. But I mean, the movie was absolutely charming. I mean, I just walked out with a big smile on my face. And how often do you say that about movies nowadays?
I'm with you, and you know, I've been in a lot of movies that, you know, even movies that people said were great that I would watch and go, eh, it was all right. This movie, I could see it. If it didn't look ridiculous to be in the movie theater watching myself, I could see this movie 3 or 4 more times and get something out of it every time, and 'cause it's so delightful and it's so rich, and just even the set decoration, all the elements that really go into making a movie, the cinematography, and you know, for me personally, I remember how beautiful Paris was when we were there, and seeing that again is a thrill. It's just a home run. It really is.
You know what I'm curious about you personally is that you've been doing this for a long time, for many years. So, and you know, right now you have this great movie with a master like Woody Allen. So you're at the top of your game, still getting all these great opportunities. But does acting fulfill something different in you now than it did at the beginning of your career?
Oh, yes. Yeah. When I was younger, this movie aside, I enjoyed being an actor much more when I was young and broke and doing theater for nothing and was full of ambition. Because the work that you do for free and the work that you do in theater is usually so much more interesting than what you get to do in movies and on TV,
mm-hmm.
because of the commercial imperative of stuff you get paid for. You know, every once in a while, I've done something on television or I've done a movie. But it's always been a small movie, like the big movies, Ghostbusters or Wayne's World or, you know, really any of them. Well, they were fun to do and there were some laughs. Movies and television are not sort of, you know, that fun for actors. Theater is. But it's ambition and the fact that I have to make a living and I have a family that really propelled me through my career. And now that I'm older, and as you get older, your ambition, whatever testosterone, I think as testosterone drops, ambition drops. And also I don't have to be as ambitious and aggressive and, you know, I push as hard. Actually, in this stage of my career, I'm more relaxed. I was for so long tortured by, am I good enough? Can I do it? Can I keep it going? I'm no good. Anybody can do it. I'm great. They're going to find out I'm fooling. You know, all the things that I imagine most actors go through, except, you know, maybe the truly great, I don't know. Or maybe the truly great are even more insecure because, you know, it's not brain surgery. It's just acting, and you always feel replaceable. As I've relaxed and I don't care about any of that stuff anymore, I find myself enjoying it again, and I find myself, when I do films, I'm just doing series, just trying to do little things to get better and trying out things. And like somebody told me, another actor, before the scene starts, if you let all your breath out, so you can't even breathe anymore, and then start talking, you'll be completely centered. So I was doing some television thing, and I tried it. And I would never have done that before. I let all my breath out so I could hardly talk. And then I started talking, doing the scene. And it was true. I was so centered, and I was so relaxed. So I'm going to do that all the time now. And that's all. That's what I do now. I try and get better in little tiny ways.
Oh, wow. But so being more relaxed and less kind of tormented about the process,
yes.
I would imagine it gives you a greater sense of, like you've been saying, freedom.
It does. And also because every job I don't think is my last job, and I don't think if I screw this up, they're going to send a memo out, you know, that Kurt Fuller is not to be trusted. It gives me the freedom that other more confident actors have when they're younger to just sort of do it for me and not mm-hmm. and it's what Woody Allen does. He doesn't worry. He so many times now in movies, they start with how much money do we want to make and work backwards.
Right.
Okay,
right.
We want to make this much, so we need a picture that will have this and this and this and this. Now go write it, and we need a superhero, and we need, you know, four naked girls, and, you know, 10 people need to die. And they do work backwards. Where mm-hmm. Woody Allen starts with an idea and works forward, and if people get it, great. If they don't, great. He did it. He did what he wanted to do, and that's sort of me as an actor now. I sort of do it the way I want to do it. I don't worry about whether people like it or they don't like it or they're happy or not happy. I frankly don't care. All
mm-hmm.
I care about is, you know, this is how I think it should be done, and I'm going to do it. And it took me personally a long time to get there.
Yeah.
Because
but
it's a business where you're constantly judged.
Right, right. But do you still feel when you return to the stage, because you have returned to the stage, or you do return occasionally, do you still feel that sense of danger on the stage that anything could happen?
Yeah. I was doing actually a series last year called Better With You, and it was a mm-hmm. sitcom, and somebody asked me to do a play in the middle of it, and I did the play at the same time on the weekends. While I was doing this sitcom, because I just needed, there's nothing like being on stage and playing a character and being in control of the character from the beginning to the end. And mm-hmm. every night it's different. And every night everything can go wrong and everything can go right. And you sometimes hit something and you finish and you don't know how you did it, but you did it. And I did a movie with Tracy Morgan that's called Nailed, that David
mm-hmm.
O. Russell directed. Probably will never come out because it got shut down and for a number of reasons. It had financial trouble. But Tracy Morgan said, comedy is like catching mercury running downhill. And, you know, you don't catch it that often. And I that's how I feel on stage. It's sort of like these little moments that work. It's so fleeting, and when you catch one of them, you never forget it. And I don't mean to romanticize it, because it's an art and it's a skill and it's a craft. But sometimes it's one of the few things where something magical can truly happen to you. And, you know, a lot of times it's mundane, there's a lot of sitting around, and a lot of times you're doing it and you're not feeling it. But when you get excited about something, it's one of the few jobs where you can actually, something magical can happen to you. You know, and that's what I still love about it.
It's that moment of transcendence.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
Well, I did this movie called Ray, and Jamie mm-hmm. Foxx played Ray Charles. And I remember after filming with him, he was so good. He was absolute top of his powers, genius. That when I finished a scene with him, I'd forgotten that he was Jamie Foxx. I'd forgotten there were cameras. I'd forgotten who I was, because he was Ray Charles. It was absolutely the most amazing moment I've had on a film, where he was so brilliant that he made me better, because you couldn't help but believe what he believed. And those are the moments that, you know, that I find are fantastic.
Yeah. I, before I let you go, you've been so generous giving me so much of your time, but we've had this gentleman on the show, and I have to ask about working with him, and that's Paul Schrader. I would imagine a Paul Schrader set is quite a bit different from a Woody Allen set.
Yes. Paul Schrader set is Paul Schrader. I did this movie called Autofocus that he directed, and I played Werner Klemperer, also Colonel Klink, in that. And, you know, I really liked him, but he is not a quiet guy. And he has a very, very active intellect, and he has no problem telling you exactly what he wants. And his way of directing, sometimes he'd come up to me and say, "So what are you going to do here?" I'd say, "Well, I'm gonna do this and that." And he'd go, "Well, show me how you're going to do it." So then I'd perform it for him. And he'd go, "Okay, good." And then I'd go, and he'd say, "Action," and I'd do the exact same thing I just showed you. That would never happen on a Woody Allen set, but there are many roads to heaven, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
He directed a really interesting movie there, and I really liked him.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's a tough movie. I mean, all of his movies are very tough and kind of uncompromising.
Yeah, and Willem Dafoe, who I got to know a little bit there, and he's always been another hero of mine. I mean, he's just so good. And, you know, I mean, and I got to be in the same room with Maria Bello while she was naked, so what's wrong with that?
That's true.
I mean who's complaining?
It makes it all worthwhile. I mean,
it does. You know, there's sometimes you go home and your wife says, "How was it today?" And you go, "Well, you know, okay." Okay.
And you get to share the screen with somebody like Jack Nicholson. I mean,
I know. I've been, you know, these people are all, you know, I mean, I really worship at the feet of some of the people I work with, and I've been very lucky and, I've been very lucky. And I hope I continue to be lucky.
I think you're terrific. And I was very much looking forward to talking to you because I've enjoyed you and everything that I've seen you in. And
thank you
so much. Thank you,
my
sir.
Pleasure, and thanks so much for your interest. And, you know, anybody out there, that movie, The Midnight in Paris, is well worth seeing.
Okay, that is actor Kurt Fuller. He is in the new Woody Allen movie, Midnight in Paris, that opens wide this Friday. So there's an article in Hollywood Reporter about Midnight in Paris, about the expansion,
mm-hmm.
and about how it's breaking records. It's doing so well that Sony Picture Classics is moving the film into 944 theaters this weekend, and that's the widest ever for a Woody Allen pick after anything else in 2003. But anything else, which opened up in 1,033 locations, and is actually one of his weakest films, I think,
mm-hmm.
It died off quick. It made like $3.2 million in the U.S.
Right.
But this one...
This one is just doing bang-up business, so I'm very curious to see how it will do once it, in that many theaters. I'd be very curious to see how... But it's getting such good word of mouth, you know? I haven't heard much bad thing
147. About it. 147 locations it's at.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, and it's accumulated $7.4 million.
Wow.
And in that few theaters, for the past three weekends,
mm-hmm.
it's been in the top 10.
That's right, yeah.
So it's already more than doubled the gross for his last movie that opened up in over 1,000 theaters. I mean,
what was the last one? What was the one?
What I just said, anything else.
Well, anything else. Okay, anything else. So, I mean, I thought you meant the one right before this one.
No, his last movie to open up in
that opened up, yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. That was a wide release. But that's also because they thought because of Jason Biggs and Christina Ricci and everything, they probably thought that would be a big
I don't know. He's got huge stars in all of his movies.
Yeah.
But why did – I mean, I'm delighted.
Right.
I just don't know why this one. It's a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like the per screen average just through the roof.
I mean,
how has this reached the public? And it's not like necessarily a word of mouth thing because it broke records in like four theaters on its first weekend.
Right. I
it's interesting. That'll be something to really look at this weekend.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it does this weekend, but I'm sure. I mean, I'd be really surprised if it doesn't move up even further. But I mean, people, it's good. But the word of mouth has been good, and I think just people want to see a funny movie, a good funny movie.
Yeah. His top grossing film, his last top grossing film, was Vicky Cristina.
Mm-hmm. How many theaters did that
play? That played at 726. 726.
Okay.
Match Point played in 512.
Mm-hmm.
They earned the same amount of money domestically, $23.2 million.
Okay.
Exactly the same amount of money. That's interesting. But I mean, this is on par. If this gross is, you know, carries over, this
mm-hmm.
will be his biggest hit in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, good for him. It's a really good movie. It shows he still has it. So I think it's wonderful.
He still got it, baby.
He still got it.
All right. We'll be back Sunday night with some great guests.
Okay. All right.
I promise. And then our Summer of 86 series is coming up soon, too. I think the week of the 20th is when we're going to start it.
Okay, cool.
So it'll be like that week, maybe three shows.
Okay.
Then the following week, another three or four shows, closing like we always do with Keith Ulick, the critic for Time Out New York, where we all have a roundtable discussion of all the movies that came
mm-hmm.
out that summer. But prior to that, we have interviews with a lot of the talents from the biggest movies that summer. And you know who expressed interest just yesterday to take part was Will Wheaton from Stand By Me.
Oh, cool.
Sweet. Yeah. Essentially the central character of Stand
yeah.
By Me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right.
Let's close off the show with a piece of score from the new Mark Ruffalo film, Sympathy for Delicious.
Wow, okay. Cool.
What a interesting title for a film.
All right.
I have sympathy for Delicious. That's why I'm overweight.
Stop it. All right. Okay.
All right, dude.
All right. Good night, everyone. Thanks.
Good night, guys. Yeah.